Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Bill Nowlin, author and editor of nearly 100 books, many of them Boston Red Sox related. He's also the co-founder of Rounder Records, and we're here talking about his latest book, Boston Red Sox Firsts, the players, moments, and records that were first in team history. Bill, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Happy to be here, Mark. Thank you.
Now, this book is an amazing feat of getting way down in the weeds to sort of glean these first records. How hard was it to put this book together?
It wasn't hard at all, actually.
Oh, come on, Bill!
For a couple of reasons. First of all, I had done a book several years ago called Red Sox Threads, and a lot of the work, that was just like following odds and ends in Red Sox history, just, and many of the threads were firsts. The first, Dominican to play for the team, the first Japanese native to play for the team, that kind of thing. So some of them I just pulled out of that other book, which is, you know, pretty much hard to print these days. And it's something I've just been fascinated with.
Oh, I can tell.
Life is following these little bits and pieces. And
now, you got to tell me, you're one of the three founders of Rounder Records, and that's a whole other thing. But what set you off in this career of being essentially the de facto historian of the Red Sox?
Well, I was a Red Sox fan growing up. I was born in the city of Boston, Jamaica Plain.
Right.
My father sold hot dogs for a couple of years at Fenway in the 30s. That was before I was born.
Oh, wow.
But that always impressed me. If he told me he was president of the United States, it would have maybe not ranked quite as high. But and I just became a Red Sox fan. He never took me that many games, maybe a couple. I just don't remember, and he could never remember to tell me. He said his father was a pretty big Red Sox fan, but I think my father was busy trying to raise myself and my two sisters.
Well, I have to imagine, if you're working the game, you don't have the same love of the game as if you're just sitting there.
Yeah. Well, I think he was kind of a fan, but I don't remember him sitting around watching games on television the way I do. I just don't remember that. I started going to games myself by the time I was 12 years old. I lived in Lexington at that point, so I just take the, for 5 cents, if you're under 14, you could take the, what's now called the T.
That's right.
And it was a one-way ticket, so for a dollar, I could go to a game, 5 cents each way.
Wow.
And 50 cents for the bleachers, and, you know, you even had a little bit of money if I, there used to be a place called Joe and Nemo's that sold hot dogs.
I remember. So what was your first book on the Red Sox? Like, what sort of pushed you over the edge to sort of become that historian, that guy?
Yeah, I got off to a great start. I happened to come across a book called Ted Williams' Hit List that was a guy named Jim Prime worked on that with Ted Williams. They were co-authors. And it was his ranking of the best hitters in baseball history.
Oh, wow.
And I got that book, and I said, wow, this guy worked with Ted Williams, who was my childhood hero. I started going to games in 1957, the last few years of his career at Ted Williams. And so I wrote a fan letter, more or less, to the publisher and said, what's the story here? How did somebody get to write a book with Ted Williams? And I got invited down to an event at the Ted Williams Museum. It was around 96, I think. And I met Jim Prime down there, and just enthusing to him about his book, we decided to work on another book ourselves. And it came out, it was us interviewing 200 people that knew Ted Williams. It was people talking about him. So it was, we talked to more than half the living members of the Hall of Fame. We talked to people that weren't in baseball. I interviewed 45 minutes with John Glenn, who was, astronaut, but also a fellow squadron mate of Ted Williams with the U.S. Marine Corps during the Korean War. They flew a number of missions together during wartime. And I talked to two different barbers that cut his hair. fishing guys.
Okay, whoa. Stop right there.
Many different perspectives on Ted Williams.
So what were the barbers' perspective? I mean, was he like telling blue jokes or what?
No, not really. It was just, I was trying to cover all the bases.
But still, that's an awesome responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, one of them said that it was a guy in Florida, and behind the barber shop there was a lot of open land, And so he said that Ted Williams would go out there sometimes and hit golf balls.
Wow.
It's like, you know, okay, why he didn't go to the golf course, I don't know. But it was fascinating. And people, you know, would make time for you that this is me, a neophyte as an author, but I could call up some of these Hall of Famers. And because it was about Ted Williams, they would take time. So I got hooked, as you could imagine.
Oh, yeah.
And then, yeah, you know, seeing, I always thought when I grew up I'd write a book, and I ended up writing several of them, but that was a great way to start. It was called Ted Williams, A Tribute, and then it came out a new edition just after he died called Ted Williams and the Pursuit of Perfection.
I hate to ask you this, because I think we're about the same age, and we're actually at Fenway Park at about the same time. Because
okay.
I saw Ted.
I remember you.
Yeah, right. You were over there.
Yeah.
Because I got to see Ted Williams play, too, when I was a wee tyke. My father took me. For people who don't understand what is so amazing about Ted Williams, I'm just going to ask you to take a moment out and talk about that. Because there are kids today who don't know who the Beatles were, let alone Ted Williams.
Yeah. Well, I always thought he was going to hit a home run every time he got
right, up. Right.
He didn't.
It was expected.
But he did hit 521 of them. And a recent book I put out, I guess it was earlier this year maybe, I found 110 of those 521 home runs actually provided the run that won the game for the Red Sox.
Wow.
It wasn't necessarily a walk-off home run in the ninth inning. In 1946, he hit his only inside-the-park home run in the first inning, but the Red Sox won the game 1-0. So his home run won the game. So 20% of his home runs actually gave a win to the Red Sox. If he didn't hit a home run, he got on base.
That's right.
It seemed like, and his lifetime on-base percentage was .482. In other words, 48% of the time, almost half the time he got up, he got on base. That's nobody, I mean, it's the highest of any batter in baseball history.
For his career. I was introduced to him through my two older brothers and my father. He was just a giant. I mean, you were looking at history and everybody knew it.
Yeah, and he was a military hero. Two
right.
wars, lost 5 years, almost.
He had his own series of bubblegum cards, which yep. I collected the whole series. I mean, who else did that? Nobody else had that.
Right. It was, as I recall, a 60-card or an 80-card
right.
set.
That's right.
It wasn't just like 5 or 10 cards.
And it wasn't all baseball. It was all about his career, his life, bone fishing and all this.
He
was an amazing figure.
He was also one of the leading people behind the Jimmy Fund.
That's right. That's exactly
for children's cancer research, and he became friendly with Dr. Sidney Farber of Boston Children's Hospital at a time when chemotherapy was mocked.
That's right.
Chemotherapy is standard these days, but back in the late 1940s, it was not. But he was out there raising money became the honorary chairman for many years, and that impressed me as a kid. I gave my 25 cents to the Jimmy
Run
when I was 13 years old, that type of thing.
I have to ask you, too, because I can feel this, and for everybody around me, my son especially, what is it about the Red Sox that engenders such devotion and fans' feeling? I mean, first of all, I have to say Fenway Park is a beautiful park. But I always think that because that's the park I grew up with.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a regional element to it. The fact that the Red Sox, I mean, you know, through 1918, they won 5 World Series, the first
yep,
one ever.
Yep.
That was one of the first questions
in the book.
Right, and then they won in 1912, 1915, 1916, and 1918. So they were a dynasty back in those early years. I look now, I had to wait 59 years. Some fans had to wait 86 years for them to win again in 2004.
Yeah.
But I look at that, and now they're the winningest World Series champions of this century, having already won 4. Nobody else has more than the Giants at 3. But 2018, and then I look back at 1918. After 1918, it took them 86 years. Do we have to wait?
Don't. I can't believe you put that out there.
Yeah. Well, I hope they're going to break that curse within the next 2 or 3 years.
There are things better left unsaid.
Yeah, but I don't know why. The Red Sox, you know, New England is a region. A lot of people that are Red Sox fans grew up here, and geography matters.
It does.
Okay to be a Yankees fan if you're from New York City. If you're from Boston, you become a Yankees fan in the 50s. That was just because you liked the team that won all the time, and that was something else. And the Red Sox became, I think, what were called lovable losers.
That's right.
People became fanatic about them, but then they ended up losing. And they lost so dramatically, so many times. The seventh game of the World Series.
Oh, God.
45, 67, 75. And 86.
You know, I've been able to put this out of my memory until I read this.
Yeah, well, it's a good thing to expunge if you can. But and then they lost, you know, Game 7 in 2003 to the Yankees of the ALCS. Plus, they were eliminated on the last day of the season in 1948, 1949, 1972, 1978, that one game playoff against the Yankees. It was inbred that you were going to lose. And so when the Red Sox finally did win in 2004, it took some of us, I can remember, for certainly the next morning, but for about a week, having to convince myself when I woke up each morning that, yes, they really did win.
I know, it seems surreal. It still seems surreal.
Now, in a way, when you look at the history and how it happened, it does seem surreal.
Now, one of the great things about this book is it has so much Red Sox history. Wrapped up, and I want to go back to the pre-Red Sox time because you talk about that a lot. As we mentioned, the very first team to win the very first World Series was the team we now know as the Boston Red Sox. What did we know them as then?
Well, they had no name, actually.
When I read that, that was surprising. I didn't know that piece of history. That was
sort of
weird.
They were called several different things, some not all complimentary. they were called several different things. Most of the places, sometimes a couple of newspapers called them the Pilgrims.
The list right here. There was the Pilgrims, the Puritans. Now, here's one I don't understand. I was hoping you could explain. The Collingsmen.
Well, their manager was Eddie Collins.
So they just were named after their manager.
They were named after the manager, yeah.
The Somersets?
I couldn't tell you right off where that came from.
And Plymouth Rocks.
Yeah, I don't know. It just seemed
so. There just was no name.
Made up name. Yeah, they ended up being called the Boston Americans because they were the Boston team in the American League. Well, of course, there were also the Boston Braves, who also went under several different names over there.
Boston Bean Eaters.
Yes, among them the Beanaters, who were really pretty dominant in the 1890s.
Now, the Boston Americans had some amazing people on them that are legendary. People are going to recognize the names. Most important is Cy Young.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people think about the Cy Young Award and all that, but he spent a good portion of his career with the Boston Americans, and then I believe his final season was 1908, where so he got to pitch 1 year for the Red Sox itself. The Red Sox had a change in ownership that year, and they decided to call themselves the Red Sox to kind of distinguish them. And the Bean Eaters had worn, there'd been a while they'd been were Red Sox, and I guess it just caught the imagination of the new owner. But 1908, Cy Young was a 20-game winner.
Jesus. He threw out the first pitch in a World Series game against Pittsburgh Pirates, and it was Kitty Bransfield, who came from Worcester, Massachusetts.
Mm.
And it was the first native of New England to get a hit in a World Series.
Ah, okay. See, you should write a new book.
you must fully expect your book to show up in every single bar. Where people have those kinds of arguments.
That would be nice.
Now, I've got to ask you, going back again to the Boston Americans, where did they play?
They played in downtown Boston. It was a place called the Huntington Avenue Grounds. It's the summit. If you were to visit Northeastern University today, there is actually a statue of Cy Young on the exact location where the mound was.
But where did the
what at that time?
Where were the did the Beaners play in the same field?
They played at a place called the South End Grounds. It was essentially across the street. It's kind of strange that later on you'd think they could work out and just share the park, but that happened in 1915 and 1916. The Red Sox played their home games during the World Series at Braves Field, which had just been built in 1914. I mean, here they had a three-year-old park, but already the Braves had put in a bigger park, so they went there because there was they could sell more tickets.
So how long ago was Fenway built?
1912. We just had the 100th anniversary.
That's right.
A mere 11 years ago.
And the Green Monster?
The Green Monster is just a sort of a name that was given. That was always there. There was always a high wall because there was a street outside. But it used to be covered with advertisements. They're creeping back. But it was then in the late 1940s, Tom Yawkey, when he was the owner, decided to take out all the advertising from inside the park and make it a pure. He could afford to do that because he was extremely wealthy. And then for a while, the Jimmy Fund had the only billboard in the park for several years.
Now, the history of the Green Monster, which you have in this book, is fascinating. Obviously, it's the left field wall. Some from the very beginning said no one would ever hit a ball over that wall.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Hugh Bradley, April 26, 1912, also the first homer in Fenway, hit it over the wall.
Yeah.
Over the building behind it, I think.
Which is quite a poke. Who knows what was going on with that. But there were some strange things. I can't remember all this stuff, but the first time that the Red Sox, maybe you've read the book more recently than I have, the first time the Red Sox, it took a while before the Red
right.
Sox had any home runs.
Well, that's it. I mean, this was a long time going. I mean, it was 1912, April 26th.
Right.
And that was the first homer in Fenway.
Yeah, that was a week into the park, though. He hit it all the way over the wall. And it was his only home run of the year. Hugh Bradley, I think. I'm trying to think about, in 1916, they played a whole season and only hit one home run all year long at Fenway.
Wow.
Tilly Walker, the center fielder. So it wasn't like home runs were all that common. This was a so-called dead ball era, and that was when people were bunting for base hits rather than trying to bang the ball out of the park.
Right.
But it was a long time before they there's a lot of adaptations. I mean, they didn't play their first night game until after World War II in 1947. They didn't play a Sunday game because of the blue laws in Massachusetts until 1942.
Right. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Bill Nowlin, author and editor of nearly 100 books, many of them about the Boston Red Sox. He's also co-founder of Rounded Records, and we're talking about his latest book, Boston Red Sox Firsts, The Players, The Moments, and Records That Were First in Team History. Now, Bill, some of the stuff that you dug out for this book, I laughed my rear end off. You had, I'm trying to look this up now. You had the first player, Tris Speaker, the first and only Red Sox player to play before the president, the King of England, and had an audience with the Pope in 1915. That's pretty stretching it.
But people don't always track those things that carefully. Who knows what it would be like today? I mean, the Red Sox just this last week had their first player born in South Africa. He only lasted about a week, Taylor Scott. He was brought up and I think it was yesterday or the day before, maybe he'll come back, but he was designated for assignment, as they call it. I didn't even get a chance to talk to him. I was going to try to catch him and find out, you know, tell me the story, because he went to high school in California, I believe. But he was born in South Africa, and you know, who knows?
There's a whole section in this book about the first Red Sox players, and there's a whole list of countries. So there's still a lot of countries left in the world that we haven't gotten a ball player from.
Oh, there are. We got to get some more guys.
Now, another wild one is you talked about what was the first role that music played in a World Series championship, and it was 1903. There was this weird booster club called the Royal Rooters.
Yep.
And they sang this. They made up these lyrics to the song Tessie, which was from Broadway, that just really laid into the other team.
The Royal Rooters was kind of the equivalent of today's Bo Sox Club. But they were a very, very active fan group. They would, you know, buy a whole section in the seating section in the park. And back then, a whole bunch of them, I don't remember how many, maybe 50 to 100 of them traveled to Pittsburgh during the World Series. They took the train down, which was not an easy trip, and certainly back then.
Wow.
But they adapted a Broadway song and made fun of the opposing players, calling them names, so to speak. Yeah, all very polite, but, you know, saying things like, you know, Hack Wilson, you don't know how to field a ball, or that type of stuff. And apparently, it kind of rattled the other team.
Well, people weren't doing that stuff yet. And so I can imagine that the other team.
Their home park too.
I know. Like, where do they get off? I wonder if I wonder if fights started over that.
Right.
Now there's that, but then there's for a person who grew up just outside of Boston. I grew up in Watertown. Mm-hmm. There's the Standells' "Dirty Water," which became a Fenway Park staple song. People who don't remember "Dirty Water," it's a song about the Charles. I love that song.
In between, there was another noted musical event. The Star Spangled Banner was played at Fenway Park during the 1918, before games during the 1918 World Series. That's a tradition now, but it was a tradition that started at Fenway Park. It wasn't even officially designated as the national anthem until 1932. But it was obviously considered a patriotic song, and the Red Sox began that tradition. Dirty Water was another tradition. It was sort of, I don't know how you describe it. I should know.
It's sort of a garage rock song.
Yeah, I was going to say kind of a grungy.
Yeah, but it was a classic for its time if you lived in Boston.
Yeah, for sure. And it was extremely popular right here. And then after Dr. Charles Steinberg and with new ownership came into Boston after 2002, he talked to some of the people that were handling the music at the park, and that they were experimenting with different things. And at one time, the Red Sox, you know, went in a walk-off, and the first song they put on afterwards was "Dirty Water," which ends with that playing, you know, "Boston, you're my home." And so that's what I think rouses people. And now, of course, if you go to a game, you can't hear it unless the Red Sox win.
That's
so
right.
It's not like "Sweet Caroline."
Yeah, you have to earn it.
The Red Sox could be losing 10-1 in the eighth inning, and the fans get all excited about "Sweet Caroline," but you have to earn it. Yeah, you have to earn "Dirty Water."
But it's got a great beat. It dun 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 dun.
It does, and I wrote a whole book about that with a guy named Chuck Burgess, called "Love That Dirty Water," and because it's the Red Sox victory anthem. And we got to know the guys in the band pretty well. They're out in California, but. They're not active these days, but they did come back and played in the World Series that year in 2004 and again in 2007.
There's an interesting thing that I didn't know this term, immaculate inning. Mm. The first pitcher to throw an immaculate inning to the start of a game was Pedro Martinez, May 18th, 2002. Now, what you should describe for the audience what an immaculate inning is.
I'm glad you told me instead of asked me, because I don't have all this stuff memorized.
Mm-hmm.
But, immaculate inning is when you come in and you throw 9 pitches. Strike, 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 strike. 9 pitches, 3 outs, inning over, go sit down, and your team goes to bat. It's astonishing, because there could be a foul ball in there as one of the strikes.
Right, right.
But there can't be anything else. There can't be a base hit. There can't be an outside pitch that's called ball one. It's not immaculate at that point. It's just another inning.
But, you know, the fact that that happened in 2002 means that there's still Red Sox records and firsts that are still being made now, or relatively now.
I mean, every day I go to a game, I hope to see the Red Sox pull off a triple play.
Yeah.
I've seen a couple of them that I went to one game where the opposition pulled off 2 triple plays against the Red Sox, Red Sox win the game anyhow, fortunately. But I just, it's such a rare event to see a triple play. I've seen three or four no-hitters, but I know I was at the park, but I wasn't paying enough attention at the time when there was a triple play. It's just something I'd like to see.
Yeah. I'd love a triple play too. I would love to see that. Now, some of this stuff is slightly obscure in this book, which I that's why I love it. For instance, the Red Sox most valuable player to also throw twice a 300 game in bowling. Mookie Betts.
Okay, yes.
2017. How do you come up with that stuff?
Well, it was in, you know, the Boston newspapers mentioned that at the time. It's not just that I happen to follow bowling, because I don't.
No.
It just came up, and then, you know, it caught my ear, and I noted it down.
Now, do you think, generally, and I don't know this, does every baseball team have its own Bill Nolan?
Well, I don't know, actually.
I can see the Yankees having one. But,
yeah.
But, I mean, does every team
in the Red Sox? I'm by no means the only person that writes deep history about the Red Sox, although I have, now that I'm retired in particular, I've been churning out book after book on the subject. Working on one now on the 20th anniversary of the 2004 Red Sox next year.
Oh, wow. Well, with that, we're completely out of time. We could talk forever about this book. This is one of those books you have to have in your home or in your bar or in your back pocket when you go to a trivia contest. My guest tonight is Bill Nolan, author and editor of nearly 100 books, many of them on the Boston Red Sox. He's also co-founder of Rounder Records, and we've been talking about his latest book, Boston Red Sox Firsts, The Players, Moments, and Records That Were First in Team History. It's sort of if you love the Red Sox, it's a must-have. Bill, it's been a pleasure.
As you can tell, I enjoy the subject matter.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you very much, Mark.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.